Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, reporting from Southern Africa.
And I'm Todd Zwillick in New York City.
We want to welcome new stations again this week, including listeners at WHYY in Philadelphia, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky, Eugene, Oregon on KRVM, listeners out in Shreveport, Louisiana on KDAQ, and over in Atlantic City, thanks anyone for listening.
And we begin this hour with continued protests in Egypt, where hundreds of thousands of protesters continue to demand the removal of the democratically elected president, Mohamed Morsi. Yesterday, the military issued an ultimatum for Morsi to meet the demands of the protesters within 48 hours or face a military-imposed, quote, roadmap out of the crisis, read, takeover. And yes, that's the same institution that was protested just 1 year ago when Egyptians demanded the end of military rule and the takedown of Hosni Mubarak. Now, President Obama spoke to President Morsi by phone on Monday, and according to the White House, told Morsi the United States is committed to the democratic process in Egypt and does not support any single party or group. Omar Khalifa is director of Egypt's O Media and was skeptical of President Morsi's regime from the start. He's been participating in the protests in Egypt, and he says they are overwhelming in their scale.
The people, they all want the president to leave. I don't see any sign of compromise. At the beginning, they started by asking, you know, for some concessions from his side, but now I think it's too late. So this time, I've never ever seen everyone participating in these protests. It was too crowded.
Yesterday, the Egyptian military issued a statement giving President Morsi 48 hours to satisfy the demands of the protesters or face a military takeover. What is the impact of that statement? Is it a matter of time now before Morsi goes? What's the next step?
Yes, it's a matter of time, and I think it was a very clear sign that the army is standing with its people. And I think Morsi had enough time to fix any problems he had. His speech last week, right before the planned protests, was useless. He didn't address the real problems. He didn't address any solutions. And it actually, I would say it fused people more, you know.
But Omar Khalifa, I have to ask, you know, it was just a year ago that people were similarly in the streets protesting the military rule after the regime of Hosni Mubarak. Aren't you worried about yet another military takeover? You might get rid of Morsi, but also be sort of back where you started.
No, I think the military yesterday made it very clear that the first sentence was that they are not seeking power and they don't want to get into any political games. They just want the will of the people. And what we've all understood, that the 48 hours is for Morsi to reach any solution, which I doubt would happen now because it's too late. And after that, I think there will be early elections, and the military made it very clear that they don't want to be involved in any politics.
Give us an idea, Omar Khalifa, of exactly what the problem is with Mohamed Morsi. It's clear that many, many people are very, very dissatisfied. On the other hand, the guy's only had less than a year in power in a country that's been ruled for 30 years by one person. Egypt, of course, is going to go through a period of transition. And from the outside, you might ask, give the guy a chance, I suppose. What's been so bad about his presidency?
I'll tell you. I mean, 1 year, I know it's not enough, but also 1 year is enough to make at least some changes. Since he became in power, the only thing he did best was to serve for the Muslim Brotherhood blindly. He received several warnings from the people to be the president of Egypt and not the president of the Muslim Brotherhood, and he completely ignored. But I would say the turning point is when he drafted the constitution with members from his party while neglecting the opposition. And that was when the mass demonstrations started months ago and ended. I think that was a major warning that he completely neglected.
On the other hand, Morsi did win an election, and the Muslim Brotherhood has millions and millions of supporters, which were repressed under the regime of Hosni Mubarak. If Morsi goes, aren't you worried about a disaffected swath of the Egyptian electorate that supports the Muslim Brotherhood? I mean, you and your friends are protesting, of course, but not everyone agrees with you. There's going to be a major division here.
I understand, but I think there is a division already. But what I know for a fact is that maybe half of the people who are demonstrating today against the president are people who actually voted for him at the first place. And they voted for him because they didn't want any other candidate from the previous regime. But as soon as they came to power, it was all clear to the people that this president is too loyal to the Muslim Brotherhood. He's not willing to give any to the country. They haven't been transparent at all in all of their moves. They have been so close with Hamas and getting them into Sinai. And so that even, I think that was the turning point from the army to start being against the president.
On the question of defending democracy in Egypt, you're facing a second military takeover in a year. Is Egypt democratic? Can it be?
I said before that it won't happen overnight. There will be some mistakes. Even if the next president comes and he doesn't fulfill the people's needs, the same thing would happen again. But the only power that we have now is the army. The people, of course, comes first, but the army is the only power that could actually take unilateral steps to take him out of power and call for early elections.
An ultimatum from the Egyptian army that Mohamed Morsi had just 48 hours to meet the demands of protesters or face a military takeover. Omar Khalif, director of Egypt's O Media, on the line from Cairo. Thank you, Omar.
Thank you so much.
You're hearing there an ecstatic crowd in Tanzania welcoming President Barack Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama to their country, the final leg of the president's Africa trip, where he spoke with business leaders and called for a renewed partnership between the United States and the African continent. Listen.
We're close to reaching a historic milestone where foreign aid to Africa is surpassed by foreign investment in Africa. And that's great news.
Takeaway host John Hockenberry is in Southern Africa all this week, and he's looking at the economic realities on the ground there. Hi, John.
Hey there, Todd. It's great to talk to you in New York from halfway around the world.
Well, John, you're in Africa at an historic moment. Former South African President Nelson Mandela appears to be nearing his final days. President Obama is on his first visit to the continent as president. How are Africans feeling about these larger-than-life figures, these icons? And is there any faith in these kinds of political figures in Africa?
Todd, let me take you into the township of Mondesa. It's right next to Swakopmund, which is a city on the Atlantic coast of Namibia. There's kids everywhere. People are bundled up in the cold, playing outside. Lots of activity here. Even a local singing group, three young men, welcomed visitors on this chilly July afternoon. Now, these three young men are typical of the experience of working men in this part of Africa. They all have strong but really distant memories of the wars that brought independence to Namibia and South Africa. Their grandparents, in many cases, fought with SWAPO, the Southwest Africa People's Organization that liberated Namibia. Some were even members of the African National Congress. That's the organization, of course, run by Nelson Mandela and the late Oliver Tambo. And there are streets named after both of them all over this region, really all over the continent. Philip Angula, who was our tour guide here in Mondesa, says there's a lot of emotion bound up in the last days of Nelson Mandela and a lot of worry about the future of this region as well.
Mandela's in a very critical condition. I think his time is also really coming to an end. And I feel that we are losing him. And people are afraid things might change.
People are ready to say goodbye to Nelson Mandela, as difficult as that is. And they also compare Mandela. He's an icon, they say, and President Barack Obama is just a U.S. president. He can't possibly compete. But the arrival of both of these individuals at such a moment in Southern Africa, I think, really does focus people on their day-to-day realities, because it's not war stories about independence that people talk about anymore. It's the economy, the fear of things getting worse that dominates the conversation. The war stories, if anything, are about putting food on the table. Here's Sammy. She's a mother of four girls. She lives in the township in a very, very humble house. It's a three-room house, and she shares it with her mother and two other families. She has no time or interest in politics anymore.
I wouldn't say very important, because I don't even vote. I don't vote because I just feel everything is not done right, or they don't do what they say, you know. Like, there are many people that are jobless, and I feel from my point of view, I'm not happy with that part, so I'm not really into politics, though.
So, John, does Sammy see any real economic opportunity for herself, regardless of the politicians who come and go? Does she see any hope of things getting better when she talks to you?
Well, let's just say she's given up. She doesn't vote anymore, and you can hear it there. Unemployment in Namibia right now is over 50%, so she doesn't necessarily have any personal hope. I mean, I think she's grateful for whatever she can get, either from the municipality or from family members who help her out. Here in this township of Mondesa, people are grateful for just 37% joblessness. And so the chance of an American president breaking through that tough reality is not really very good. And Philip Angulo, who we heard from moments ago, says he has few expectations about the United States president anymore.
So far, I can't really say that I have seen many benefits from the USA government, which I also don't expect for them to be done. I personally believe people are not really concentrating on Obama anymore. I think it's about Mandela, the fact that he's in a very critical condition.
Well, John, as President Obama wraps up his three-country tour of Africa, when the world is paying attention, you know, he's been carrying the banner of investment and trying to draw the attention of Western economies into Africa once again. But to me, it sounds like those communities are a long way from seeing any of the trickle down from any investment that comes, and really they know that they're a long way from it.
Well, I think the idea of an American president helping out anyone on the ground in Africa, and particularly in a place like Namibia, is always a remote prospect. And there's nothing new about that with Barack Obama. But I do think that 4 years ago, the sense of hope and the blunt amazement that people had that an African-American, that an African could get elected president of the United States, that amazement has given way to the practical realities of that it is a trickle-down situation. And your chance of getting any of the trickle is really the luck of the draw. And I think it's reinforced a sense of cynicism. And with the backdrop of Nelson Mandela's last days on everybody's mind here, I think it really makes people feel cut off and a little bit alone.
Still, John, I don't want to feel like a lack of hope necessarily means hopelessness, does it?
No, it doesn't. And I think the hope here is that people are, reveling in the second and third generation of independence, particularly here in Namibia. And I think that's true in South Africa as well. I mean, for all of the difficulties of what's going on in Africa right now, and as Barack Obama said, you know, many of the fastest growing economies in the world are right here in Africa. People are doing it on their own. And that sense of being on their own, for good or ill, I think is where the seeds of hope are in this region right now.
It's our own John Hockenberry reporting to us from Namibia as he takes a tour of Southern Africa. John, thank you.
Yeah, Todd, I think I'm having better luck at having a vacation here on the Atlantic side of Southern Africa than Barack Obama and his family have had on the Pacific side trying to go on safari. I've been aware of all the difficulties that they've been having. So for the luck of the draw there, we're doing pretty well.
It sounds like you have a bit more privacy, too. Thanks, John.
Yes, indeed.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Well, after days in a Moscow airport transit area, Edward Snowden broke his silence through a statement issued by WikiLeaks. Now, part of his statement reads as follows: the Obama administration has now adopted a strategy of using citizenship as a weapon. Although I am convicted of nothing, it has unilaterally revoked my passport, leaving me a stateless person. Without any judicial order, the administration now seeks to stop me exercising a basic right. A right that belongs to everybody, the right to seek asylum. And that's the end of Ed Snowden's statement through WikiLeaks. Now, Snowden, who remains in that transit area in the Moscow airport, as I mentioned, has abandoned his request for asylum in Russia. This is after Russian President Vladimir Putin said asylum would only be granted if Snowden ceases leaking classified information against the United States. Listen.
If he wants to stay here, there is one condition. He must stop his activities aimed at inflicting damage on our American partners, no matter how strange it may sound coming from my lips.
Meanwhile, it doesn't seem like Edward Snowden is out of options. The president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, is in Russia right now, and he says he's not yet received an application requesting asylum from Snowden, but keeping open the possibility of granting such status to the leaker. It's all getting rather twisted on the world stage. For more, we're joined now by Ellen Berry, Moscow bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times. Hi, Ellen.
Hi.
Well, Ed Snowden remains in the transit area, as we mentioned. Has Vladimir Putin completely closed the door, or is it Ed Snowden that's closed his own door in Russia?
You know, it appears now that Putin's speech yesterday aimed to dissuade Ed Snowden from applying to Russia for political asylum. He had, in fact, already submitted a request. That was something that wasn't public when Mr. Putin made his speech. But this has been a sort of balancing game that analysts and people around Putin have been trying to work out over the last few days. If he's seen to be refusing Ed Snowden protection, that would go over badly on a public level. However, if he accepts Snowden as a political asylum, that could cause ongoing problems that are unpredictable in nature with the United States.
Or option three, of course, is to do nothing, Ellen Berry. And now it seems that maybe Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela, hey, he's in Moscow and so is his plane, could just give a ride to Ed Snowden back to Caracas.
So that is a possible way out, and the number of ways out is not huge, so everyone's watching that fairly closely. But Mr. Maduro wouldn't commit today. He was a little bit evasive about his plans. He said he wasn't going to fly him back, in fact, today to Caracas, and again, sort of articulated moral support for him without giving any concrete, you know, further steps towards offering him asylum.
Well, Ellen Berry, Moscow bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, with us now in studio is Kimberly Martin, political science professor at Barnard College and Columbia University here in New York. For more on how this saga and this diplomatic limbo could impact U.S.-Russian relations. Hi, Kimberly.
Hi, Todd.
Thanks for being here. Let's start with Vladimir Putin and Edward Snowden's diplomatic limbo. There have been reporting over the last couple of days that when Edward Snowden arrived in Moscow, there was a great deal of media making, pop-up television shows that seemed to be laying the groundwork for Edward Snowden's popularity amongst the people in Russia that seemed to point to granting him asylum. He's a hero. He's our kind of guy. But that's not where this appears to be going.
No. And Vladimir Putin has to worry not just about appealing to the public in Russia, but about appealing to his personal informal politics network, which is based mostly on the power ministries, the old KGB, now the FSB. And Putin sent some very strong messages to that network. The first was that the FSB and the FBI have interests in common. He announced that the two presidents, Obama and Putin, had asked those agencies to get together to try to resolve this issue. And the FSB doesn't like leakers any more than the FBI does. We know what the KGB does to people who betray it. We remember the Litvinenko polonium poisoning in London a few years ago. That was sort of their message about if you betray us, this is what happens. They don't want betrayers on their territory either. The next message that Putin sent is that sovereignty is not at stake here because a lot of Putin's domestic supporters like him for foreign policy reasons because he's brought back Russia as a great power that doesn't bow to anybody. But Putin has said sovereignty isn't at stake here. He's not in Russia. Snowden isn't in Russia. He's in this, you know, in-between land in the airport.
We don't have jurisdiction
there. We don't have jurisdiction. And the international lawyers kept on saying, but that's not true. Russia certainly does have jurisdiction. The reason that Putin said that, I think, is that he's sending messages to his domestic supporters that sovereignty is not at stake here. And the other thing to keep in mind is that in May, things changed between Putin and Obama because of an exchange of private letters. Obama sent a private letter to Putin with some suggestions for cooperation. Putin reciprocated and published this in the Russian newspapers before the summit meeting in Northern Ireland. And by doing that, Putin was sending the message that Obama is now in his desire to have a personal network of reciprocity and good relations with Obama. So at this point, if Putin were to accept Snowden's bid for asylum in Russia, it would be a personal insult to Obama. So for all of these reasons, it made perfect sense that Putin would set this up in such a way that Snowden would not have any likelihood of staying in Russia.
Russia.
How fascinating. So what we're seeing, instead of just sort of naked populist politics, is a lot of sub rosa relationships between, at the top, between Putin and Obama, but also solidarity among spies. Nobody likes leakers, and everybody in that community gets it. So what about Russia-U.S. relations? You mentioned this this ongoing dialogue between Obama and Putin. It now seems like Putin, from our perspective, or at least our government's perspective, has done us a solid.
Well, yes, and he's left himself open for some kind of a deal, and I wouldn't be surprised if part of the deal has to do with cooperation following the Boston Marathon bombing, because you'll remember that there was a complaint coming from some U.S. actors that the Russians hadn't done enough to share intelligence information. This is sort of an opening that says now the FBI and the FSB can work together in the future with support from the two presidents, and so this might be a way for U.S.-Russia relations to overcome the impasse that they've had in the past few years.
And yet the statement from Putin saying that he doesn't really have jurisdiction over the section of the airport appears to preclude what I'm sure American authorities, the FBI, would like, which is to go in there, render him, and get Ed Snowden. That's not going to happen.
Yeah, that probably will not happen. I would be very surprised if that happened. Because at that point, that does seem to impinge on Russian sovereignty. If you have foreign security agents coming onto what everybody agrees really is Russian territory.
Well, there is a fascinating window into the real politic of U.S.-Russia relations between Barack Obama, Vladimir Putin, and Vladimir Putin and his network in Russia. It's not just about what the people think. In fact, it doesn't appear to be about what the people think at all. Kimberly Martin, political science professor at Barnard College at Columbia University, thank you so much.
Thank you, Todd.
Tokyo, Rio, Sydney, Los Angeles, Tulsa? Tulsa, Oklahoma? You heard me right. Tulsa, Oklahoma, in the Dust Bowl state, is bidding to host the 2024 Summer Olympics. This is no joke. The man spearheading the effort is here with me today to explain why. Hi, Neil.
Hi. How are you doing, Todd?
I'm fine, thank you. Neil Mavis is a member of the 2024 Tulsa, Oklahoma Olympic Exploratory Committee. Neil, I had no idea such a thing existed.
Well, a lot of people think that, and it's a lot of people also think of Tulsa as a flyover Dust Bowl city, and that's why they don't even think about them. So it's understandable.
You heard the list of Tier 1 Olympic cities throughout history. Why should Tulsa join them?
Because the big surprise is we've got all of the athletic infrastructure in place that Atlanta did at the same stage of the bidding process. Like I said earlier, a lot of people think of Tulsa as just a flyover Dust Bowl city at the end of the Trail of Tears. But after we did the research, we found out that one of the leading things is the state spends about a quarter of its state budget on higher education, on the university system. And because of the associated athletic facilities that go with it, we've actually got the same amount of athletic facilities in the same radius of Tulsa that Atlanta did at the same stage of the bid process.
Amazing. So this is to say that Oklahoma's obsession with college football, essentially, is your gain in the Olympic process.
Not just football, but it's a bunch of other sports. We've got three Olympic training sites here in Oklahoma. We've got archery, volleyball, and also rowing here.
Does Tulsa have enough, roads, infrastructure? I mean, you look at some of these cities, Beijing, they didn't just build the Bird's Nest Stadium. They built roads and highways and interchanges and train stations, probably even train lines just to handle all the people.
Well, there's a couple of ways to look at that. The official IOC bid documents state that you need to have 40 to 45,000 hotel rooms. And if we put four people in each room, that's less than 200,000 people that you need to accommodate. And the official bid documents also specifically state you need to have room for 5,000 athletes, specifically for dorms. So we're looking at only a total of about 200,000 people that are going to be showing up for the games. And as far as the infrastructure, one of the things about the United States is a lot of our cities have got a lot more infrastructure than a lot of other cities around the world. And here in Tulsa, we've got plenty of fiber optics. So that's one of the keys to the Olympics, is it's a major televised event.
Well, my last question for you, Neil Mavis, before I let you go. We like to deal with 30-second pitches in this business, in the radio business. So if I'm an Olympic, International Olympic Committee bigwig, and I'm looking at bids from Stockholm, Buenos Aires, and one from Vladivostok in Russia in 2024, you got 30 seconds. Sell me on Tulsa. What does it have over Stockholm?
Well, our bid theme is Native America. We're internationally recognized for Native America. We've got 7 Olympic sports that come from Native America. 26 states in the United States are named after Native American words or phrases. The greatest Olympian of the first half of the century was Jim Thorpe. He's right here in Tulsa. And we believe that we could not be just a city bid or a state bid, but a bid for the entire United States. And because of worldwide recognition for country music, Route 66, and Native America, we've got a bid theme that's going to basically challenge any other city in the world.
Neil Mavis, this particular IOC bigwig sold. Neil Mavis, a member of the Tulsa 2024 Olympic Bid Committee, thanks so much.
Thanks, Todd.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It has been a devastating week for the residents of Yarnell, Arizona. The entire town has been evacuated after a raging wildfire destroyed hundreds of homes and took the lives of 19 firefighters there. One member of the community, Yarnell Church Pastor Paul Jones, has been counting the seconds until he can reunite with his community and offer refuge for those needing relief, and he joins me now. Hello, Pastor.
Hello, Todd.
It has been a terrible day since we heard of the death of 19 firefighters. How are people there coping?
Grief is hard to explain or hard to deal with, and it's just taking hold now. I was in attendance with a memorial service yesterday, sponsored by Congressman Gosar, for the 19 firefighters who died. The response of the community of Prescott from where these firefighters came was incredibly great. The grief that will be felt over these next weeks and months is hard to describe at this point. Many of my parishioners have lost their homes. Mine is still standing at this point. The way that I'm getting information is basically from a son of mine who is on the fire line who calls me after the morning briefings. The fire is still out of control. Until it is mastered, we cannot get back in. And as you said, I am extremely anxious to get back to my community.
There are still images on television of what I assume is the community meeting, the memorial that you described. We're seeing those images of grief-stricken families. It's heartbreaking.
It is indeed. It is indeed. And the shock is still the most powerful effect of it right now. The true grief is yet to set in.
Is there any indication, Pastor Paul Jones, of when residents of Yarnell can start to return? You mentioned the fire is still out of control, but I don't know how far away it is from the town there.
We don't know at this point. The fire continues to move between Yarnell and the village of Peoples Valley, which is 3 miles north. The fire is moving along the hillside, the base of the hills, and in the valley floor below. I am 30 minutes away now in another village, and I'm looking in the direction. It looks like there may have been some rain there during the night. I pray that to be so. Our area is extremely dry. The only caution that we have is when thunderstorms begin to come in now, that the lightning will be more significant than the precipitation and cause more fires.
Pastor Jones, I have to ask you about faith. It must be very difficult. I know that you're thankful for the people who are safe and for the fact that your son is safe since he's a firefighter, but faith has to be pretty hard given such a tragedy in your community.
This community is made up greatly of retired folks. They have come here from all over the country. They represent everyone from retired university professors to farmers and ranchers. They have an incredibly strong faith. They are all shaken, obviously, by all of this, but already I'm receiving emails and phone calls that reflect the faith that they have that we will be able to rise from this and we will be able to rebuild. Our greatest concern right now is not for what we have lost materially, but for what we have seen happen to the families of the hotshot crew who perished in the fight of this fire. Faith is important to this community, and it will see us through.
Of all those phone calls and text messages that you get, Pastor Jones, I know that the one you get from your son each day when he's done with work is the best one you get.
It is indeed. He is the person who is most vehement about me not showing back up over there. He loves his dad, and he doesn't want me to get hurt. So we had a discussion yesterday, and we finally determined that we were both very stubborn people, but very much in love with each other.
Well, all I can say is hang in there. Pastor Paul Jones, we're thinking about you here on the East Coast. Pastor Paul Jones is pastor of Yarnell Church in Arizona. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Todd.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Well, Cardinal Timothy Dolan of New York has long been considered one of the good guys of the Catholic Church. He's an outspoken supporter of the victims of the church's clergy sexual abuse scandal. Listen.
When you think of what happened, both that a man who proposes to act in the name of God would have abused an innocent young person, and that some bishops would have, in a way, countenanced that by reassigning abusers, that's nothing less than hideous. That's nothing less than nauseating.
Well, that's an unequivocal statement from Cardinal Timothy Dolan. However, new documents released this week by the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Milwaukee paint a different picture of Dolan, formerly Archbishop there in Milwaukee. They reveal he was very much part of the church's attempts to prevent church assets from going to the abused and encouraged abusive priests to leave the church voluntarily in exchange for stipends and benefits. In fact, in 2007, in a letter to the Vatican, Dolan requested the transfer of $57 million in church assets to a trust fund for cemeteries in an attempt to, as he put it, quoting now, protect the funds from any legal claim and liability. That's the end of that quote. Lori Goodstein broke the story yesterday for the New York Times. She is national religion correspondent there. Hi, Lori.
Hello. Great to be with you.
Lori, it is rather earth-shaking for a church figure who has been, as I said, at least perceived as one of the good guys of the sex abuse scandal in the Catholic Church. Why did the church decide to release these documents now?
The Archdiocese of Milwaukee is in the process of bankruptcy proceedings. They have been sued by as many as 575 people who claim that they were abused sexually by priests or by employees of the Archdiocese. And so part of that process is that the alleged victims were insisting that the church reveal the documents. And so they were about to be forced to do so, probably by the bankruptcy judge, but a day before, back in April, the Archbishop of Milwaukee, the current Archbishop Listecki, Jerome Listecki, decided that he would voluntarily make them public, 6,000 pages of documents.
And this spiriting away of $57 million into a trust fund for cemeteries by Dolan, allegedly, did it succeed in shielding that money from victims?
Well, we'll see. That money is now in play in the bankruptcy proceedings, and the lawyers for the victims are insisting that those should be part of the assets that are available to the creditors, and most of the creditors in this case are the abuse victims.
But Dolan himself, who, I should repeat, was the Archbishop of Milwaukee at the time in 2007, has vehemently denied doing this, correct, or shielding any money?
Well, when he was first accused of this a few years ago, he said it was absolutely malarkey. There's no way he was hiding assets. And I think it's because he has insisted that those monies were always intended for the care of cemeteries. The question here is the timing. In 2007, the Milwaukee Supreme Court decided that, in fact, the archdiocese could be liable for abuse lawsuits. Before then, there were decisions that made them effectively immune. And so that transfer of money was made very soon after that Supreme Court decision. And indeed, soon after that is when all the lawsuits were filed. I want to say that the files reveal another side of Cardinal Dolan, which was that he did a lot of things right. You see him writing to Rome, requesting priests be removed from the priesthood, pressing cases where Rome was dragging its feet, and saying that, you know, the victims are asking us to get these priests out of the priesthood, and that also it will be a scandal and a problem for the church if they remain in. So you see him advocating really on behalf of abuse victims as well. The news in these documents was a document that revealed that indeed he did move this money with a motive. He says in the letter to the Vatican that the reason he wants to move the money is that we'll improve the protection of these funds from any legal claim and liability. That's why there's heat on him today.
And that sort of belies the previous claim that this money was always meant for cemeteries. In the first place, it doesn't appear to stand up to scrutiny. We've heard so much over the years, Lori Goodstein, before we let you go, so much about the extent, the depth of the abuse, not just in Milwaukee, of course, but in dioceses across the nation and probably and indeed around the world. Did we learn anything new about the abuse or the follow-up to the abuse in Milwaukee from these 6,000 pages apart from the money issue?
Well, I think there are people who were victimized in the Milwaukee area who are reading these documents very carefully. Some people didn't know how their cases were handled, didn't know that, in fact, there were other abuse victims. You know, they're reading those documents. They might have been told, oh, you're the only one accusing this priest. It can't be true. And then they see in these documents that, indeed, there were other people coming forward. So the documents go back 80 years. So we also see how long the church has been grappling with this.
New documents, 6,000 pages of documents specifically released in Milwaukee, the story broken by Lori Goodstein, indicating that Cardinal Timothy Dolan, the Cardinal of New York, who was Archbishop in Milwaukee at the time, did, despite his previous statements, move some $57 million out of the reach of sexual abuse victims. We will see if that money remains out of reach. Lori, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, coming up, we're talking about cookbooks from around the world and how we can use them as an indicator of economic development. We're wondering what's going to be on your dinner plate tonight. Janine in Nantucket texts us this. I'm on this curry kick, just crave it and can't get enough. And from Adelise in New Jersey, hummus, guacamole, basil chicken, edamame, and polenta is on the menu this week. For our listener in Greenville, South Carolina, it's all about coconut rice, curry sockeye salmon, and a great Greek salad, caprese kind of thing. I mix it up. And for our listener in Alpharetta, Georgia, what might end up on the dinner plates this week are two popular slices from the Mideast. One is a mixture named za'atar, and the other is sumac. We are addicted to them. And your host on The Takeaway is now starving. This week, Americans around the country will have their great American cookouts, the 4th of July barbecue. You're going to find menus with classic American foods, hamburgers and steaks, barbecued ribs, pork and brisket. But on the other 364 non-patriotic holiday days in the year, our dinner plates don't always look quite so American.
This is Claudia Farber from Highland Park, New Jersey. What might end up on my dinner plate is Thai, Japanese, Greek, or Turkish, courtesy of a local restaurant. And certainly hot dogs on the 4th.
What we eat and where our food is from says a lot, not just about the influx of foods from different cultures and different countries around the world, but can also serve as an economic indicator. Some foods, like Mexican and Chinese, are world famous, but are they really better than food from, say, Indonesia or Namibia or El Salvador, foods we don't see all the time on the street corner? Economist Tyler Cowen has been looking at what food says about a country's overall economic health and influence globally. He's the author of An Economist Gets Lunch, New Rules for Everyday Foodies, and he explains how cookbooks are an indicator of economic development.
Well, think about a cookbook as a measure of economic development. So if you have a very poor country, recipes are highly idiosyncratic. They depend upon very local sources, or maybe what one grandmother knows. But as a country becomes richer, it has more restaurants, it sells food more widely. Recipes need to be standardized. They need to be written down. That will get you cookbooks. It will also get you economic development.
But the most popular form of foreign food, if I can call it that, in this country, of course, is, well, it's probably Chinese. China is definitely an emerging economy. There's no doubt about that. But Chinese food has been popular here for like two generations. I mean, my grandparents ate a lot of Chinese food in New York City, even when it was a poor country.
I would say in this country, we've only been eating real Chinese food for the last 5 to 10 years. What we used to eat was really American food, which we called Chinese to make ourselves feel exotic. But as China has become wealthier, it now has a lot of good real Sichuan, real Hunan restaurants, and they're coming to this country. So I think it fits the pattern exactly.
Oh, well, that's interesting. American food dressed up as Chinese. I think that's certainly true, even most of the places you go to today. Well, you try to explain in the difference between two countries that are right next to each other that are economically similar, say, you know, China and Turkmenistan. We eat a lot of Chinese food. Turkmenistan has basically a similar GDP, but I've never even seen a Turkmen cookbook or restaurant.
You know, other factors have to do with how much a country trades and how many immigrants it sends out. So Chinese food and also India, they've sent out a lot of their citizens all over the world. That spreads cuisine too, but it's also another symbol of economic advancement.
How much of this is marketing? You know, you give an example of a Chadian restaurant. Have you ever been to a Chadian restaurant? I think most people would have to say no. I can't name one, but I've traveled in that part of the world just like you, and the food is delicious. What would it take for a Chadian restaurant to be successful? A lot of this is perception, not just ingredients. Somebody walking down the street might think, oh, Chad, desert, poor, I don't want to eat that. But it's a marketing issue also, isn't it?
Sure. People still say that about Ethiopian food. But one thing we could do is take in more immigrants from Chad. That would help. And it's interesting in how many African countries actually Chinese food is common. So there's also a sense of tradition that people run restaurants because their parents or grandparents did. And that feeds upon itself.
There are a lot of poorer countries, Tyler Cowen, that seem to piggyback on sort of a regional perception. Of course, Thai food, Vietnamese food, and Chinese food kind of are the mantle of Asian cuisine in this country, but an increasing number of Laotian restaurants, Burmese restaurants, those are poor countries. Are they sort of piggybacking on the Asian food obsession that Americans have, or do they have something special going on?
They're piggybacking, but they taste very different. But once you get a person to try Thai food, almost certainly they're willing to try food from Laos. Or once a person likes Mexican food, they'll usually try food from El Salvador, even though the taste is very different. So we're seeing this slow spread toward a state of the world where Americans are willing to try, if not quite everything, you know, the foods from at least 50 or so countries around the world.
And there have to be exceptions to this rule. I know that there are economists love to fudge a little bit, Tyler Cowen, you know that. So let's talk about places where maybe your economic rules of culinary delight go wrong a little bit. I can think of one converse, maybe South Africa, where the president has been visiting. It's probably the most economically advanced country in all of Africa. I've never seen a South African restaurant, I don't think. It's not popular.
There are a few South African restaurants, but they tend to serve something a bit like British colonial food. But keep in mind, South African food is a bit like food in the U.S. They have great Indian food, good Chinese food, mixes of many different things. It's not clear what exactly South African food is, and that's actually a sign of the country's development.
Because they take in so many immigrants themselves that maybe their own sort of home cooking has gotten diluted?
As do we in the United States. Or fly up to Toronto and ask yourself, what's the food of Toronto? You'll be totally baffled.
And if you travel overseas and go to what might be called an American restaurant, what are you going to get? Just is it burgers and hot dogs? American cuisine to the rest of the world tells them what?
But again, that's getting a bit better. So if you go to a city like Berlin, which was once mostly German food, it now has food from around the whole world. And some of their American restaurants do barbecue, not as good as we do it, but it's getting better. And over time, we can expect cities such as Berlin to actually have real American food.
So, Tyler Cowen, before we let you go, what's the one emerging country, the one emerging economy that I need to look out for either on the cookbook shelves or restaurant rows in Washington, D.C. that's going to tell me that that country economically is coming into its own when I see their food?
Well, I think the two are still Mexico and China. We have a lot of Mexican and Chinese food, but typically only from particular regions. And that choice is going to get much richer. And that, again, is reflecting progress in those countries themselves.
And my advice, if you're listening to this and you want to find Mexican food that maybe hasn't been in your town, Oaxacan. You don't see it anywhere, and it's absolutely amazing. We have it in Washington. Tyler Cowen is author of An Economist Gets Lunch, New Rules for Everyday Foodies. Thanks, Tyler.
Thank you.
So we want to know what kind of food will end up on your dinner plate tonight. John Hockenberry, what about you over there in Namibia?
Hey, Todd, you got yummy snails here, fantastic oysters here. We got kudu on the carpaccio. It was really, really delicious with lots of local spices. There was a warthog leg served with lots of garlic, which was quite delicious. Springbok jerky. But if your three-year-old acts up like last night, you may want to try the German pizza place around the corner here in Swakopmund. And that was very, very successful.
That all sounds all right, John. I'm going to opt out of the warthog leg if that's okay with you. But how about the rest of you? What ethnic cuisines are you eating for dinner? Aaron in Portland says this.
I'm Vietnamese and have to have at least three bowls of pho a week. That delicious beef noodle soup runs through my veins, breakfast, lunch, or dinner. Doesn't matter. It gives me superhuman strength and cures the worst hangover.
And for this listener in New York, the prize goes to Jamaican food.
This is Christine from Queens. By far my favorite is Jamaican. And when I get Jamaican, I get Jamaican curried goat or stew oxtail, and I love that with white rice. There's nothing more delicious than having that.
Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway.
If you want to get a jump on all our early conversations, be a part of our listener response network by signing up for our text. You'll get one text a day. We ask you a question featured on the next day's program so your voice becomes part of our on-air conversation. Just text the word START to 69866. That's START to 69866. Thanks so much for listening.
I'm Todd Zwillick.
And I'm John Hockenberry, reporting from Southern Africa, and this is The Takeaway.